Welcome to the Grants for Investing podcast, where each episode we explore the business of investing with purpose so that hopefully you can make a difference for the investments you make. I'm your host, Ray, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Lucy. Lucy, how are you?
I'm very good, Ray. Excited to be with you for another host discussion episode. The idea of the host discussion is simple. We explore and discuss one topic each time, with our favorite coffee, of course.
Of course.
Today, we've got a very interesting company that we're going to talk about, Robinhood, the stock trading startup, who recently raised funding again, $200 million this time, continuing towards becoming the alphabet in the fundraising space. Ever since late March this year, we've seen a whole group of people jumping on their Robinhood accounts or their other free trading accounts and really seemingly pushing up the markets, with a lot of institutional investors still questioning how sustainable is this rally. So to start the discussion off, Ray, for those who's not familiar with Robinhood, can you quickly talk about what they do and some of the key features that they have?
Yeah, so Robinhood is basically a online trading platform that gives retail investors like you and I access to listed companies on, say, for example, the S&P 500, and to be able to trade them without brokerage, actually. So really one of the cores to Robinhood's success is really through applying the formula that a lot of social media sites such as Facebook have used so successfully by making it, one, free by removing the brokerage fees, two, easy to use, and free gamified. So for example, if you've never used the platform before, for example, when you make your first trade, they'll say, congratulations, and then the app will actually show confetti pieces. It's very colorful. It's super easy to use. The user interface is just highly intuitive. So really what the Robinhood team have done is make the whole process of investing super easy and have almost gamified it in a way that, say, if you're a first-time investor and, say, you're unlocking, say, options trading or margin trading, it almost feels like you're leveling up in a game, which before Robinhood, no platform had ever really approached investing in that way. And I think that's one of the main things that really differentiates Robinhood from the competition. And so going back to their point around free trades. So Robinhood's main pitch from the start was basically removing that brokerage fee that came with every single trade a retail investor like you and I would have to pay. And in this way, they claimed they were basically democratizing finance for all. And it's interesting because you wonder, okay, if they don't charge brokerage, how exactly do they actually make money? So we dug a little deeper, and it turns out that they make money for a process called payment for order flow. So basically, they will take your trades as a retail investor and then pass them on to these massive Wall Street order processing firms like Citadel Securities that will then shave off a percentage of the bid-ask spreads on your orders. And then in turn, Robinhood will take a percentage commission off the money these order processing firms take from your orders. So what that means at the end of the day is that instead of paying an upfront, say, brokerage fee, you actually end up not getting the best purchase or sell price for your investments, which means you're paying through the back end, actually. So it's a bit ironic in a way that I guess Robinhood is marketing themselves as helping the retail investors and taking away from the Wall Street players when they're actually also helping the Wall Street players profit. And I think the other really interesting thing to note with Robinhood is that because it's so gamified and easy to use, it's almost made investing something that young investors like you and I will do on a day-to-day basis. So it's really accelerated this process of what's known as day trading and speculation. And oftentimes, this has been done by novice investors who really have no idea what they're doing or not much experience with investing. And whilst this has historically been an obstacle, the combination of the gamified approach and free brokerage has just made this super easy for day-to-day investors to get involved in. And in fact, We were just looking at the numbers, and almost half of Robinhood's 13 million users have never actually invested before signing up. So we found this to be a very, I guess, interesting trend and a reason behind this sudden increase in day-to-day trading and speculation that a lot of, I guess, media firms have picked up over the past few months. And looking towards a more broader trend, outside of just Robinhood, it's really interesting to see that a recent ASIC report showed that since March, retail investors have actually poured over $9 billion into Australian shares alone, whereas on the other hand, institutional investors have withdrawn over $11 billion. So you get to see this almost strange dichotomy in how retail investors and your more traditional institutional investors have reacted to, say, the COVID-19 pandemic and the subsequent economic recessions that have impacted share markets globally. And you're probably wondering why this is. And so part of this does go back to what we were just discussing around the whole Robinhood investing process, as well as potentially other factors out there. So many speculate that increased government stimulus, behavioral aspects of things, so say FOMO, as well as potentially a lack of other alternatives for spending money, including the inability to, say, travel and go on overseas holidays, or even being able to, say, go to a casino and gamble or bet on your favorite sporting team. So it's really interesting to see and explore some of the key factors that have really driven this sudden trend in increased retail investing over especially just the past few months. So now I guess that's just a bit of a high level overview of some of the key trends that we found interesting looking into the space of retail investing. And we mentioned, I guess, quite a few different terms there. And one of those is, I guess, the whole speculation and day trading side of things. So Lucy, I guess I was wondering, and I'm sure as many of our listeners out there are wondering, what is that all about?
Yeah, day trading, as you briefly mentioned earlier, is in its name this investing approach of buying and selling a financial instrument within a single day. It could be stocks, it could be cryptocurrency. For example, if you buy and sell Bitcoin within a single trading day, you're day trading Bitcoin. The goal here really is to take advantage of small fluctuations of price within a short period of time, which can be influenced by many factors like important news and announcements. For example, Fed announcement. Now, day trading is famous for its ability to make money quick compared to, say, long-term investing. But on the other hand, the risks of it usually outweigh the rewards and can be extremely addictive, which is why I guess many people also call it gambling. There was once a time when the only people who were able to trade actively in the stock market were those working for large financial institutions. However, with the rise of the whole online trading platforms like Robinhood, it's become a lot easier and cheaper for the average individual investors like you and I to get in the game. There are obviously pros and cons when it comes to day trading, but like other investing strategies, day trading isn't for everyone. So it's very important to do your research and decide if it suits your personality and investment goals. So now, Ray, what's your personal opinion on this and I guess this trend around the rise of retail investing?
I think there are both positives and negatives to all of this. One thing is, in terms of, say, a pro, I do think that whilst, yes, these trading platforms like Robinhood have created almost an incentive to day trade and speculate short term, I think it's great that at the same time, it's encouraging everyday people like you and I to really get involved and I guess have a greater awareness about investing and in the investing space in general. Mm. And also, funnily enough, those people, those retail investors who bought in, say, March and April, really timed the market perfectly, because if you look at, for example, the US indices, they're up 30, 40%. Since their March lows, which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
And you think, how often can that actually happen? And so they did actually time it really well.
Mm.
But indeed, going back to your point around this sudden, I guess, increase in day trading and speculation, I think it's also interesting that a lot of the increase in retail trading has also been around trading options and more complex financial derivatives. And whilst this speculation and this, I guess, investing in options isn't necessarily a bad thing in of itself, the problem really lies in the fact that retail investors often lack the necessary background knowledge and awareness of risks to trade such complex derivatives or to be able to effectively day trade or speculate. Even industry professionals often lose a lot of money trying to manipulate these financial instruments and derivatives. And so for a regular investor like you and I to somehow be able to constantly beat the market is definitely no easy feat. And there are significant risks involved with that. So, for example, a recent ASIC report, which was released back in, I think, April, March, showed that one, trading frequency had increased significantly in the last few months, whilst at the same time, the duration for holding these investments fell significantly. And an interesting thing was that on days when retail investors were net buyers, the report showed that more than two-thirds of the time, shares actually fell the next day. So whilst you often hear in the news these stories about people getting rich overnight through day trading, there's a significant portion of investors out there that are losing a lot of money trying to bet against the market or bet for the market. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that these complex financial derivatives, such as options and CFDs, they're really designed to magnify your investment exposure and sensitivity to, say, market volatility. And this obviously, whilst it creates significant upside, it also creates significant downside. And so, for example, if you took a triple leveraged call option against a particular stock, if that company stock went up, say, a dollar, then that would say the equivalent of it going up $3. But if it went down a dollar, you'd be losing $3 for every $1 you invested. Mm. So you can really see that your losses can quickly spin out of control and you can end up losing a lot more than you could otherwise afford to. And so that same ASIC report noted that, for example, during the week of the 16th of March, which was sort of a very, very volatile week for markets globally, retail investors actually lost from just a sample of CFDs over $200 million in that week alone, which is, you know, quite an astounding amount of money to lose in such a short period of time. Mm. And it really reflects just how, I guess, volatile and risky these sorts of derivatives can be for investors.
Mm. Another news that I saw earlier in late Feb and early March this year was during the whole sharp market decline and increased volatility, trading activity surged and Robinhood actually experienced a couple times of extensive outages that affected its users' ability to access the platform at all, leading to a number of lawsuits. However, Robinhood's customer agreement, this multi-page document that most customers electronically sign without reading, is intended to legally absolve the firm of any responsibility for these outages. Another thing to notice about Robinhood is, despite its easy-to-use interface, it doesn't necessarily translate to easily understanding what you're trading, particularly when you're new to investing. There is very little research or resources available on the platform. Customers must pay at least $5 per month for Robinhood Gold in order to view market death data and access research such as Morningstar reports on high volume stocks. I guess the bottom line here is weigh the pros and cons before you choose your investing platform. Just because many people are using it doesn't necessarily mean that it will suit you as well. Okay, so now we've talked about our thoughts on Robinhood and some of the trends that we've seen in the past couple of months. Let's also talk about, in general, some of the things that people should consider before or when they start investing.
Yeah, well, I think there's quite a few things, but probably a common theme that we've been discussing so far is just around the whole risk side of things. So we did mention this in our actually in our previous discussion episode. So if you haven't listened to that already, feel free to go check that out. But we can't emphasize enough. The importance of, one, setting financial return objectives, as well as understanding what your risk appetite is as part of this almost due diligence process. And at the end of the day, it comes back to what's known as the risk-reward concept, right? As in, the more risk you take, theoretically, the more reward there could be. But at the same time, the more losses there could be as well. So you really need to be able to balance and figure out clearly before you make an investment what your risk-reward profile is. So for example, if you have a low risk tolerance and you can't afford to lose much money, you really shouldn't be, say, taking on investments where you're using options or derivatives that are magnifying your potential gains or losses, because then your risk-reward profile is no longer in sync and you're going to find yourself potentially with an outcome that is not what you plan for. And the other side of things is really being able to set a way to measure and benchmark how your investments are performing, both from a risk and a financial return perspective. So whilst it's important to plan ahead and really set out your goals before you invest, once you invest, you really need to be able to monitor and track how your investment is doing. And say, for example, setting a stop loss order at a particular price target. So you know if basically if the stock falls at this point, you're no longer going to lose any more money than you otherwise would. And when it comes to risk, I think it's important to, at a high level, consider both systematic and unsystematic risk. So what I mean by this is that, so systematic risk is something, say, like the COVID-19 pandemic, right? Something that very much affects markets globally and the share market index as a whole. And I guess ultimately risk that you can't diversify away. On the other hand, when you're investing in, say, a specific company like Tesla, an example of unsystematic risk would be a risk that affects only that company. So for example, if Tesla's battery factory in Shanghai was somehow affected by, say, a natural disaster or had an electric outage or something like that, then that would be an unsystematic risk that you should consider before making that investment. And ultimately, really, at the end of the day, you really should never invest in something that, one, you don't understand, and two, you can't afford basically to lose that amount of money that you invest. So never invest more money than you can afford to lose. And really, I think from our own investing experiences, I think what we've learned is that it's important to start small and gradually build up. And there's nothing wrong with sticking to safer investments initially, and then as you learn along the way, then eventually moving to more, I guess, ultimately some of the more exciting things like investing in particular companies or even using options, etc. And so there's this concept called the investment risk pyramid. So basically, you've got your less risky investments, say bonds at the bottom, which offer you obviously a low return, but very low risk. In the middle, you've got things like equities, property, and at the top, you've got, as we mentioned, a lot of these financial derivatives like options. And so before you invest, you should really consider, okay, which tier on this pyramid do I belong in? And which one do I feel most comfortable in? Because that'll then ultimately determine what you invest in and your appropriate investment strategy, given your risk appetite and, I guess, the funds you have available to invest with. Lucy, I think you had some other ones to add as well.
Great explanation. Well, another important thing to consider before or when you're investing is your investing time frame, which is the period where you expect to hold an investment for. Are you looking to invest only for a short period of time, or you want to invest your money for longer term, say more than a year? Generally speaking, we will recommend longer term investing because stock market is more effective in generating wealth when your investments are left over for a long period of time. In the short term, stocks can be irrational. It can go up and down very quickly, like what we've seen this year. But in the long term, stocks are more rational. Also, like anything else, the longer you invest in something like knowledge, a skill, or money, the more powerful compounding works. But again, choosing an investing time frame is very personal. It's largely determined by your investment goals. For most people, it's best to plan for a mix of different types of investments. Now, Ray, is there any resources about investing that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think resources-wise, that yes, whilst I think a lot of the resources out there are behind paywalls, as we mentioned before, so things like Morningstar's premium ratings, reports, etc. There's actually a lot of awesome free-to-access resources out there for everyday investors to really read on and, I guess, access as part of their investing process. So one that I personally really love to follow is The Swedish Investor. So it's a YouTube channel that really summarizes some of the key classic investing books like The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, and really takes those books and the key concepts explored in those books and converts them into short, bite-sized videos that really capture the need-to-know takeaways of each book without you having to literally invest the time to read all these books yourself. Because, you know, we understand as millennials that oftentimes it can be, one, a lot of effort, and two, a lot of time and commitment to, say, read a 500-page book. So The Swedish Investor is an awesome YouTube channel that really summarizes a lot of the key concepts that will be super useful for you as an investor to take away and apply in your day-to-day investing approach. And now I know that Lucy, both you and I, our next recommendation, we both, is one that's very close to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both of us have been a huge fan of this one for a long time. It's called Equity Mates Podcast. They are one of the largest Australian business podcasts. They really try to break down the world of investing and help everyday investors like you and I to get started on our investing journey. We really like their style. They're very funny. They make content that's very easy for even beginners to understand. They also have many experts interview from the industry, discussion around latest news and trends, also a variety of resources and articles on their Equity Mates website. So do go check them out if you haven't. Now, that's all about investing, but if you've been following our podcast for a while, you would have noticed that we're both passionate about impact investing in particular and really believe that it's a powerful force to help address some of the most pressing issues that we're facing right now. But for those who's not very familiar with the concept or new to the podcast, Ray, can you quickly define for us what impact investing is?
Yeah, awesome. So yeah, as Lucy said, we have explored this in quite some detail in some of our previous episodes, but as a bit of a recap, the GIIN or GIIN defines impact investing as investments made with the intention to generate positive, measurable, social and environmental impact alongside financial return. And so Lucy and I both see the power of impact investing as providing people with the ability to put their money towards causes and problems that are close to them, and really being able to almost generate financial return whilst creating a positive impact for someone else around the world. And we think that's absolutely awesome. Mm. And so let's dig a little deeper into what impact investing is all about and maybe highlight some of the key characteristics that, say, maybe differentiate it from regular investing as we discussed it previously.
Yeah, for sure. So impact investing has been gaining a lot of interest over the past few years, and it's currently valued over actually $700 billion, according to the GIIN 2020 Annual Impact Investor Survey. The industry also plays a pivotal and increasingly important role in supporting the for-purpose sector in particular in achieving positive social and environmental outcomes. We discussed the intersection of finance and philanthropy in depth in our last episode with Vicky Morris. Check it out if you're interested in the topic.
It was a good episode. Mm. So now to bring it back to some of the numbers, the GIIN 2020 Annual Impact Investor Survey actually showed that of the investors they surveyed, over 99% of them found that their impact goals through their investments were either met or exceeded. And over 88% of them said that their financial return goals were also met or exceeded. So it really goes to show that impact investing, you really can have it both ways. And whilst this sounds great, obviously there are still some challenges for the non-institutional retail investors like you and I out there who do want to get involved and say invest with purpose. And so some of this includes, one, measuring impact consistently across different areas, just because I guess impact is a lot harder to measure consistently, say, relative to financial return. And just because you don't have those established frameworks and ratios there, as well as finding direct platforms and options through which to impact invest. But I guess having said that, we want to, as part of this podcast, really give our listeners the ability to take practical steps and get advice into really impact investing themselves. So we wanted to share with you some of our resources that we found most useful. So one is, as we mentioned before, the GIIN Annual Impact Investor Survey 2020, and which basically takes a high-level overview of what's happening in the impact investing industry, some of the key trends, the key players, how it's evolved over the past year, and what's going to change in the next 12 months. And we think it's a really great summary and I guess gateway into learning a bit more about what impact investing and the industry is all about and where it's heading. And
I believe that they release one every year, right?
They do, yeah, they do. And so every year they sort of cover some of the high level changes and really what's changing in that industry. And so it really piqued our curiosity seeing some of those key numbers and figures and trends and hearing from some of the respondents they interviewed. And so we would really highly recommend you guys go check that out. It's an easy read. It's only a few pages and super easy to digest and just a great way to get an overview on what the industry is all about. I know you have some extra resources as well to share with our listeners, Lucy.
Yeah, I'd like to share this podcast that we've mentioned last time with Vicky. It's called Good Future Podcast. It's a great podcast around impact investing. They have a lot of in-depth discussions with industry leaders around how finance and innovation can help address social and environmental problems. So both Ray and I listen to them pretty regularly and have found it really helpful in understanding the industry. Oh, interestingly, this podcast is also how we first got introduced to the whole impact investing space at the beginning, and a major reason that inspired us to start our podcast as well, to spark more discussions around how each and every one of us can make more positive impact through our everyday life. Another tool for investors who's looking to impact invest is this metric called ESG scores, which measures a company's environmental and social practices and its corporate governance. You can find out about a company's ESG score very easily from sources like Yahoo Finance or just Google it. Many research has continued to show that companies with higher ESG scores are more resilient and tend to perform better in the market as well, especially during times like this. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ray?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because there's also an interesting trend with a lot of companies out there releasing sustainability reports themselves, and which sort of highlight, I think, some how they've performed from a sustainability and an impact perspective. So maybe for some of your favorite companies out there or companies you're looking to invest in, feel free to just Google if they have a sustainability report. And that's a great way to get an understanding of, hey, how is the company that I want to invest in performing, not just from a financial return perspective? And before we wrapped it up, we did also want to cover some interesting investment examples out there that you yourself can potentially look into investing. So one is actually around the emergence of ethical ETFs. So these are basically exchange-traded funds which are listed, say, on the ASX or on the US indices, such as the S&P 500, and that take a basket of investments and then screen them using positive or negative screening. So, for example, a lot of these ethical ETFs will actively screen out companies that, say, produce tobacco or are involved in arms dealing or manufacturing, those that have poor governance. So there's actually a lot of options out there when it comes to ETFs for investing in companies that have passed these screening processes and have met a particular ESG score benchmark. And going back to a recommendation for the Good Future podcast, they did do an episode with BetaShares on this, who do, I guess, run a lot of these ethical ETFs. So go check that out if you haven't already. And the other option outside of investing in, say, ethical ETFs is actually to invest directly in companies with almost direct impact agendas. So one example of this is, say, Australian Ethical Investments, which is a listed investment fund manager on the ASX. And so really their mandate and their whole business model is around only investing in companies that meet their strict impact criteria. So really their entire business model is based around creating impact through the investments and the work that they do, and making sure that the people who invest their money with them not contributing to industries that may not have a very positive social or environmental impact. So I think that wraps up some of the key investment examples that we wanted to share with you guys and that potentially you guys can look into. So we wanted to really thank you for joining us on this episode, and where we sort of explored some of the key trends and really the rise in retail investing, and also how to get more involved with the impact investing space as part of this trend. And so once again, thanks so much for joining. Lucy, did you want to add anything else before we wrapped up?
Nope. Just looking forward to more morning coffee discussions.
That's it. That's how we get through these podcasts. So thanks so much for listening and tuning in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you learned something new and enjoyed the episode as much as we did. While you're here, feel free to follow us on social media at our Instagram account, Grounds for Investing.
The Grounds for Investing podcast and the persons involved may have positions in the companies mentioned. This is general advice only. Please speak to a financial professional to understand how they pertain to your individual situation.